KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Searching Protect Duwamish.
He was my personal mentor as governor. I tried to emulate much of what he taught me when he served as governor.
Hey, when are we going to do this whole Veronica Mars movie, huh?
I don't know. You got a couple of $1 million lying around?
So you can see how much room there is. So I like this one because it has the big windows. I have to have that light in my life, otherwise I feel like I'm in a shoebox.
Taking a tour of an apartment, a micro apartment. We're going to find out more about that. Also, some folks have decided to use Kickstarter to raise money to make a movie. And we're going to talk about that in our chat room. And you heard Governor Gregoire talking about Governor Booth Gardner and his influence on her career and on Olympia. We're looking again at Olympia since they are still in session, week 10, state legislative session in Olympia. Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and political columnist for the Everett Herald. He joins us with a look at what we can expect in this week. Jerry, good to talk to you again.
Well, good morning. Good to talk with you again.
I imagine there's some buzz and some discussion about Booth Gardner and his legacy in Olympia. What have you heard?
Well, I think it's as the lawmakers return from their weekend away and town hall forums, they're going to start swapping some stories, especially those who have been around Olympia for a while, because everyone seems to have a Booth Gardner story. They just they remember him with smiles, and those who were involved in the conversation about Death with Dignity Act in 2008, remember him as being at the front of that effort, being tireless. Even as he battled Parkinson's, he was there and available for reporters, for lawmakers, for the public to talk about the situation and try to move that measure.
Did you ever talk to him?
Quite a few times over the years, actually had a chance to, in that year during the initiative, interview him at his place in Tacoma. It was interesting. He wouldn't know me at all, but he opened the door and spent probably an hour longer than we had scheduled. And not because of Parkinson's, but because he just kept talking. He had stories after stories. And some of them were related to what we were chatting about on the initiative. Some of them were related to what he wanted to see happen in the Tacoma waterfront. Some of them wanted to, were related to the bridge in the area. He really cared about Pierce County, and he really cared about just sort of chatting about the state of people in the state of Washington.
You know, three things are coming across here in thinking about Booth Gardner. He was kind of a people person kind of guy. He liked schmoozing with people, even though he didn't necessarily like asking them for money. He seemed to be somebody who tried to reach across the aisle, though he had a better economy to deal with at the time, but he reached across the aisle. He tried to make some compromises. He wasn't a head knocker, though he was an arm twister. What do you think he would have made, or what was he making, of today's Olympia?
You know, I think he was a little frustrated, like many lawmakers, governors and state lawmakers who have been, who were around Olympia, say, in the 70s and the 80s. I think they've all become frustrated with what's happened here and everywhere in terms of the sort of the partisanship, the line that's been drawn. I mean, as the state has become a more complicated place to govern, as the budgets become immense and the many more billions of dollars with which to spend, et cetera, rather than working closer together, it feels like a lot of the folks are working farther apart. And I think that frustration, yet he never, in our conversations, he never seemed to be cynical about it. I think it was just more of a tone of whether he just couldn't figure out why people increasingly couldn't agree to disagree and be agreeable about it. He just wanted people to chat even when they differed, and I think he'd be frustrated.
Very different tone today.
Yeah.
Tell me, since we were talking about Governor Gregoire, too, and I know this is a posting you did on your blog a week and more ago, Obama cabinet options dwindling for Gregoire. Doesn't seem like, at this point anyways, she doesn't seem to be going to D.C.,
Yeah, I have to say, there was the Washington Post, and I went blank on the name of this columnist he wrote recently about this last week, and He thought she might be the recipient of the Susan Lucci Award for cabinet appointments because her name has been mentioned so often and she's received nothing. I think the Secretary of Interior position that has now gone to Sally Jewell of Washington was probably the one position she wanted most. There are other positions out there, but I don't feel she has any kind of a desire to rush out and be the Secretary of Transportation or the Secretary of Energy. She is enjoying her time with her granddaughter, with her family, kind of reconnecting with Washington at a different level than she's been over the last 20 years as an elected officer. Now, does that mean in 2014 she won't join the Obama administration in some capacity? No. I think at some point she'll want to get back in the policy game, and there will be something that will open up for her. But right now, I don't think she's pressing to get back there.
Interesting. So, Jerry Kornfield, what is happening this week in Olympia that we should keep our eye on?
Well, there's going to be two tracks going on. This is a week where the committees are really going at it. You know, the policy bills, they start off in one chamber, and last week they had to be kicked over to the other chamber or they died. So all the various policies, whether it's education or health care or public safety, transportation, if they're policy, not budget bills, they now are being considered in committees this week and right up until April 3rd. So those will be happening every hour. Meanwhile, on Wednesday at noon, the new revenue forecast is going to come out. And that's a prediction of how much money the state's going to have to spend in the next two-year budget. And that number will be what the House and Senate budget writers use to write their budgets. And so it's a key number. It's going to be whether or not there's a big gap or a small gap. I mean, there is going to be a gap. There's going to be a deficit or a shortfall, I should say. And we'll learn Wednesday afternoon what that figure is.
Well, we already saw it grow because of some accounting issues with Medicaid. Is anything leaked out yet? Any people looking one way or the other, forecasting?
I think everyone's doing kind of a guessing game. They're expecting, and I think the folks right here are sort of anticipating, that Medicaid cost that they hadn't anticipated, coupled with they're going to feel over the next 2 years a lower than expected collection of taxes, and it's because of the federal budget cuts, partially, or the sequester, because a lot of people are going to have furlough days or they're going to be uncertain about their careers with the federal government, or maybe the nonprofits that are dependent on federal grants are not going to receive money, so they're going to spend less. So I think folks are expecting that it's not going to look good, and that by the end of the day Wednesday they're going to be talking about a $1.5 billion shortfall in the next budget, and that's before they deal with education.
Ouch. Have you heard where they would cut? I mean, this is, of course, the budget grows, revenues overall grow, but this is a cut in the growth. But they have cut quite a bit, and they have this shortfall. Have you heard where they might be cutting?
Well, here's where a couple of places where they'll probably consider. There is what if folks remember, Initiative 732. It called for cost of living increases for teachers, and they've suspended them the last couple of years. They may have to go back and suspend them again, and that will save a couple hundred million dollars. There could be other areas of higher education that they might not fund increases. They might just keep the money the same, and that would be essentially a cut. I mean, part of that shortfall is created by the state saying, okay, if we do everything we're doing now and then we add in inflation, that has a dollar figure. Well, if they don't add in inflation, if they don't spend more in various programs, then they can save money. It's the Olympia cut. It's a strange math, but they will have to probably reduce some eligibility for some human service programs if they wish to get some money, or they're going to have to borrow from the capital budget, which means money they might invest in building buildings, they might shift over to funding programs.
It's an Olympia cut, but at the same time, don't they have to take into account growing population and therefore more demand on services?
Well, they do, and that's kind of the what they've done the last couple of years, for example, with the basic health program, the basic health plan, where it's a subsidized insurance for low-income families. They've kept reducing the number of people in that program and charging them more to be in it. So They could charge more to raise some revenue. The capital budget is another place. I bring that up because what happens, and they have done this before, is they've sort of loaned money or borrowed money where they take money from the capital and stick it over in the operating budget and try to figure out how they can bridge the gap. Some of this is that there will be more revenue coming in than they had last go-round, but a lot of that is eaten up by just trying to keep paying for what they're already paying for now. So it's going to be an interesting... I mean, clearly, taxes, I haven't said it, but there will be some taxes. I think that there's some couple of temporary taxes. They were supposed to expire on June 30th. They told us 3 years ago they'd go away, but they're on things that people might not be upset if they continued. A tax on beer, a tax on lawyers and accountants. It's supposed to go down. Maybe they'll extend it and figure there won't be a huge backlash.
Was there also was this the lawyer tax, or was there something about some B&O taxes had been extended had been raised?
It's the business and occupation tax. They had a surcharge. I mean, it's just more language, but those folks had to pay a larger share of their gross income over the last 3 years. And they could be that surcharge could be made permanent, and they'll continue to pay more, a larger share. And when you start extending those two taxes that are supposed to expire, that's I want to say close to $600 million. And now you're talking about closing a big part of that deficit.
You mentioned Jerry Kornfield, who reports for the Everett Herald. You mentioned higher education, whether they would get more money. There was some talk that they would get more money in return for not raising tuition this next time around. The legislature has to come up with all sorts of money, apparently, for funding education. Have you heard any Republicans or Democrats say taxes, either those taxes or additional taxes, will be part of the way we move forward?
I have not heard any Republicans embrace any tax, extending any taxes or closing any particular tax loopholes. None have come out and said, I'm ready to do this. That said, it's going to be part of the conversation. The governor later this month is supposed to put out a plan of a list of tax loopholes he wants to eliminate, and the theory is that we'll raise a lot of money, so there has to be some big ones in there. And the bigger they are, the harder they are to fall, because there's lobby groups and organizations that don't want to see them go away. So there'll be some conversation probably on a few small tax loopholes. And I think Republicans will get on board, and I won't be surprised if they agree to extend one or more of those surcharges and taxes that are supposed to expire. Those sometimes are easier to do since they're already being paid, and the organizations behind them are not necessarily maybe they won't fight it as hard. Someone's got to do something along the revenue side. I don't see them investing in public education the way they want to, or the way they say they want to, and taking care of the shortfall without coming up with more revenue than is coming in.
By the way, speaking of lobbying, last week the bill to conduct background checks for private gun sales died when it didn't come up for a vote. Now supporters are talking about trying to get it with an initiative. Some are saying, let's wait until we have more people coming to the polls and a bigger election year. Did you see the lobbying? Could you see the lobbyists wandering the halls and twisting arms, or was it all behind closed doors and on phones?
Well, the twisting of the arms was behind closed doors. The on the phone was into the district. They were getting the residents and the constituents to call and email. I heard lawmakers from the area I cover in Snohomish County talking about getting more calls or emails on this issue than any other that they had seen in recent years. So, it was going on. It was really going on just a handful of lawmakers. On the Democrat side, they had about 47, 48 lawmakers ready to vote for it at some point. But there was only one Republican who had ever said that he would support it. A second Republican lawmaker had signed on but then backed away under pressure. So it was close, but I don't think they ever reached 50 or more votes that they needed to get it on. And there may be some Democrats and Republicans kind of wishing that it had happened, because now they may see it on a ballot in 2014 right alongside their name, and so they're going to have to figure out where they stand on it.
We shall see. Jerry Kornfield covers Olympia as a reporter and columnist for the Everett Herald. I appreciate you taking the time again.
Oh, no problem. Anytime.
Thank you. We'll talk again. Have a good time in Olympia. This is Weekday.
10:20, we'll find out about a new option for living small, micro apartments, in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the School of Teaching ESL in cooperation with Seattle Pacific University, presenting an information session on training options to teach English as a second language in the U.S. or overseas at 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 20th in North Seattle. Details and registration at schoolofTESL.com.
44 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. We've had scattered showers. Forecast says showers likely through the morning, then possible this afternoon, although the sky is going to turn partly sunny, they say, and we should hit a high of 50.
Support for KUOW comes from Clipper Vacations, offering daily trips and overnight packages to Victoria, B.C., and whale-watching day trips. Information on these and many other Pacific Northwest getaways online at clippervacations.com.
I'm Bernard Woollett. It's 10:21. A conversation about the cultural pulse of the city in 20 minutes.
What are we calling that again?
What do you want to call it today?
What was the German
Stammtisch.
Word? Stammtisch. I like coffee klatsch too, but you're not into that coffee klatsch.
I prefer Stammtisch.
I prefer Stammtisch. The Stammtisch.
Stammtisch it is.
It's coming up in 20 minutes. We've been talking and looking at micro housing in Seattle, small apartments that offer cheaper rents for less living space. We're gonna go into them even more today if we can fit into them. KUOW's Amina Alsadi and Jeannie Yandel went to visit an apartment because, Amina, you're thinking, maybe that's what you'd like to live in.
Yes. Well, I think the thing that makes me really want to live in one is the rent. It's really affordable, and that's what caught my attention right off the bat. So since I've been looking for an apartment, those have stood out to me the most because they're like between $440 to $900, depending on how much square feet you want.
Yeah.
Well, as I think you were probably about to say, they're really, really small. You're definitely paying for this.
So when the three of you and Jeannie and the guy who lived there, Dane.
Yeah, his name's Dane.
How'd y'all fit in there pretty well or what?
We all fit in there pretty well, but, you know, none of us put our arms out or did cartwheels or anything. We all sort of stood and didn't move a lot and, you know, pivoted when we wanted to look around. It was about 200 square feet, I think, Dane's place was.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Did he have a bed on the floor or did it fold up into a...
It wasn't a Murphy bed.
It was just a
platform bed on the floor. It came furnished with a desk and a folding chair. There was a fridge. There was a sink. There was a microwave. He had a window. You know, it wasn't bad.
Did you go and look at the shared kitchen?
We didn't spend a lot of time in the shared kitchen, but we walked through it. And, you know, the appliances looked nice. Everything looked new and it looked clean, right, Amina?
Yeah, that's exactly what I liked about it. It looked really fresh and clean. He did mention that his walls were really thin, so that makes me think that, you know, it is what it is. But you're getting what you pay for. But it, from appearances, it looked really nice. And I thought, yeah, I think I could live there. Although, as I was contemplating it more, I realized if I ever wanted to have friends over, we would have, like, game night on my bed or, like, movie night on my bed. And I don't know if I want to socialize on my bed because that's essentially the space you have there. You have a bed. I mean, his desk was really teeny. I think you could fit about a laptop, but then no other books or anything. And I mean, I kind of had this romantic idea of living really simply. By moving into an apartment, I would, you know, get rid of all the shackles of materialism and just live this really simple, simple life. But I have a lot of books and I don't want to get rid of them. So
you could turn them into furniture.
That's true. That's true. You're really creative.
You could do what Holly Golightly did and just take a bathtub and saw it in half and make that your couch, like in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. All right. So the reason we're talking about this is because they're interesting and because some neighborhoods aren't so sure about it.
Yeah. So the two places in Seattle that they're popping up really quickly over the last 3 years, there have been a bunch of developments popping up in the University District and on Capitol Hill. And there are neighbors on Capitol Hill who are concerned about the quickness that these things are going up. Dane Carita works as a hotel manager for a luxury cruise line based in Seattle. He spends most of his time working on the boats. If he has a couple of weeks off, he can usually find places to couch surf.
Hey, friend, can I come over for a little bit? Thank you. Here's a bottle of wine. Thank you.
Dane owns a house on Capitol Hill, but he rents it out because he's gone so much. Late last year, Dane was going to be off work for several months, and he didn't know where he was going to stay. That's when one of Dane's crew members mentioned microhousing.
You know, I applied and I got in the same day. So it was, there was one left. I was so thankful I got it.
Dane lives by himself in about a 200 square foot space near Group Health on Capitol Hill.
So you can see how much room there is. So I like this one because it had the big windows. I have to have that light in my life, otherwise I feel like I'm in a shoebox.
You can stand in the middle of the room and stretch your arms out and spin around without hitting anything. But that's about as much big movement as the space allows.
It's really comfortable. Just tiny, that's all.
Dane's rent is $775 a month. That includes water, utilities, and internet. Everything except cable. Dane's lease is month to month, which is ideal for his job. And his place comes with a private bathroom, a bed, and a desk. The only thing missing is a stove, so Dane cooks in one of the shared kitchens. That's where he runs into a lot of the other residents.
Everyone walks by and always talks about, they're like, what'd you make today? What have you created? They like to have little samples when I'm down there, so.
No one seems to have thought through what's going to be the long-term consequence for the neighborhood of having structures built where people are not encouraged to put down roots and stay for a long time.
Patrick Tompkins lives near Group Health on Capitol Hill, too. He's a builder and contractor who spent the last 14 years restoring his 1908 home. He's also a founding member of a group called the Capitol Hill Coalition. They're a group that works on zoning and land use issues on the Hill. Lately, they've spent a lot of time on microhousing, which Patrick says is sprouting up like mushrooms.
This is an entirely new housing type. Now, new housing types are a good thing. And the land use code really should be flexible in allowing people to innovate. In this case, they didn't do that at all.
In Seattle's land use code, it all comes down to kitchens. The code defines single dwelling units in several ways. But the number one way is the presence of a full kitchen. So generally speaking, one full kitchen equals one single dwelling unit. In the neighborhoods with microhousing, a development with more than eight kitchens triggers a design review. That's a public process involving the city, the developer, and the neighbors of the proposed development. In the microhousing development Dane Carita lives in, there are 56 private spaces, or pods, for people to live, but only seven or eight kitchens. That means no design review.
I think this was the result of some developers very carefully reading the land use code and realizing that there was a loophole in the land use code that revolved around the definitions of what a dwelling unit was and what a household was, and realized that they could come in and build very large structures without having to go through the very tedious process of design review.
Patrick's not anti-micro housing. He says there's a screaming need for affordable rentals on the Hill. But developers of apartment buildings where couples and families can live have to go through a design review first. That can hold up construction for more than a year. Patrick thinks it isn't fair that some developers have to complete a design review before breaking ground, while developers of micro housing don't.
If you're going to build large structures like this, then everyone has to play by the same rules.
This particular housing type wasn't necessarily anticipated, but it's not as though the developers are getting away with something. It's allowed by the code.
That's Brian Stevens, a spokesperson for the Department of Planning and Development. He wouldn't call the land use code allowing microhousing a loophole. It's code that's been around for more than 30 years, traditionally used for fraternity houses and single-family homes with rooms for rent. Microhousing didn't start showing up until around 3 years ago, at the height of the recession. Today, DPD is tracking the number of microhousing developments in the city and looking at whether there needs to be more of a public process before microhousing gets built. Microhousing resident Dane Carita can understand why.
I get it from their point of view that, yes, you're throwing another 50 bodies in where four would normally live. But let everyone enjoy it as well. I want to be on the Hill. This is my home. I love it up here. I would move here specifically for that. And this just was just an affordable way for me to actually be here and get to enjoy it and get to be part of the Seattle that I love to be around.
North of Seattle, Snohomish County officials are considering a proposal to build microhousing developments. Meanwhile, down at Seattle City Hall, Councilmember Tom Rasmussen is looking into a moratorium on future microhousing developments. I'm Jeannie Yandel, KUOW News.
Well, Jim Potter has spent 35 years in the real estate industry. He established Kauri Investments in 1987. He's the owner and president of La Serena Holdings. Jim, it's good to talk to you.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So tell me something. Where or would you like to build a micro housing complex?
Well, this type of housing has been around for a long time, and it's actually there's quite a bit of talk about it across the country. There's projects going on in New York and Boston. We're working on projects in both Portland and in Oakland. So it's really demand by the customers and by the residents to have a lower price product than is available in the marketplace.
Do you have you looked at any built by any of your competitors or at all in Seattle?
Yeah, I know something about the other products that are out there.
What do you like about them? What's good about the micro house from your perspective?
Well, again, I would just say that our customers are demanding it. The residents, the people of our city, want to live in dense places, walkable, and great communities. And there's a real demand for people living in those communities. And so they're looking for a lower price point that's lower than a conventional apartment building. A conventional apartment building unit pricing starts about $1,200 and goes up. And so there's a whole market segment underneath that $1,200 a month that's available and that people are interested in, some people are interested in renting it.
You know, you said that this kind of housing's been around for a long time. It's been around as boarding houses. It's been around as quads for colleges. We used to see much smaller houses themselves, not just apartment buildings, but houses themselves built. Are we moving back overall into that direction as the costs of larger places rise?
Well, it's not for everybody, but yes, I think for certain times in your life or you get a job transfer and it's a contract job for a short period of time and you need a place to stay. So there are people that live out on the perimeter somewhere who want to come into Seattle and work 3 or 4 day weeks. That's one customer type. You also got students, people that are going to school, people that are in the hospitals for short periods because they're going there for some medical issues. So there's a place for it in the marketplace, we believe.
What's the micro housing building permitting process been like for you in Seattle?
Well, going through the permitting process is always a difficult process. It takes time and energy. So, I don't know what you want me to compare it to, but
whatever else you usually go through when you go through, is it the same as just permitting a regular apartment?
It's no. Typically, these products we're not having to go through design review, and in some cases we get our environmental review because we tend to be smaller projects, and so we don't go through those typically. Although some of them are going through design review and going through SEPA.
Because they're larger, or because they're in particular neighborhoods? Do you know why?
You're asking a technical question. There's different thresholds for different zones, as well as for different parts of the city.
Yeah. All right. So, what do you think of that push by suggestion by Tom Rasmussen and others to bring these smaller apartments, micro houses, projects under design review, whether they reach the threshold right now? What is it, 47 units? What's the number of units?
It depends on which zone, and I don't think we should go there and talk about the numbers because we'll confuse ourselves. And
I'm confused already, but what should they all be under design review? Does that make sense?
Well, the design review doesn't really accomplish what the people, is what I understand they're worried about. It doesn't really... It won't change who the customers are. I think there are really two issues here, in my opinion, Steve, and those are really who are the people that are living here and what kind of people are they? And number two, is there some parking issues? We're worried about parking. We're worried about people competing with our parking that we have on the streets already. I think those are the two primary concerns that I've heard, and we're very sensitive to that, and we understand that people don't, change is hard.
You know, am I right that you have a permit for 116 13th Avenue East, 13th and John?
Yeah. No, that's not mine at all. That's I think that's one of the other brands.
Oh, is that somebody else? Yeah. When they want to put these developments in, as you say, people are worried about parking. Is that legitimate today?
Well, a lot of times that's coming from people's own personal vantage point and worried about protecting their own parking, but typically in these units, most of the customers don't have parking. They use car to go. They use Zipcar. They take the bus. They ride their big biking community. And they're always on very dense neighborhoods with good transit and good access to retail. So you don't necessarily need a car. And if you have a car, you can still, you can store it somewhere else. You can store it out in the perimeter somewhere. You can store it other places and go use it on weekends or when you want to do, out of area trips. But for your day-to-day activity, you don't need a car.
When you design a micro housing complex, Jim Potter, with Kauri Investments, what are the criteria in the building? Like, what do you want to see in those buildings to make them attractive, livable, long-lasting?
Well, we build good quality product anyway, so I don't think we should talk about quality, although I've seen some comments of people claiming they're not quality, and I have to beg to differ with those folks. But typically people want their own space, and that's what these customers are looking for. All their alternative is to go to an old-style rooming house or some other model in which, in these particular units, everybody gets their own bathroom, which is a big deal, especially to women. And they want good light, as I heard what you interview somebody earlier, like a big window or good access to natural light. And they want their own space where they can lock the door and say, that's mine, and it's going to be there when I come back, and I didn't have anybody else messing with it. And I furthermore don't have to deal with a bunch of other people worrying about whether they have a job and whether they can pay their rent and be part of a roommate scheme in which, you have to worry about whether they bring home a dog or bring home a friend or have a bunch of other issues that people have to deal with.
Where is in one of your projects, where's the shared kitchen and how many people share the kitchen?
Well, typically in this configuration that we're talking about, it's eight rooms per kitchen through our central kitchen. And they're typically, nicer spaces, but frankly, the kitchens aren't used very much. I mean, I heard discussions about this, but the kitchens are not used very much because these people are busy.
That's interesting.
They have jobs, they go to work, maybe they work at a restaurant, but they're busy, and the kitchens are used very rarely.
That's interesting.
People are on the go, and a lot of times these people are working and going to school, and they don't hang out in their unit. And I heard a discussion earlier about playing games on their bed is the only place they got. But the idea is to use the shared space of community out there. Use the restaurants and the bars and the coffee shops is your community space. And that's where you meet your friends, and that's where you go.
Does that suggest something for future as you're building these micro houses in terms of the space that's devoted to the kitchens?
I think that's true. I think that's a discussion, and each developer of these things will have to decipher themselves. But the whole idea is to really get people out walking into the streets and into the, again, out in their local community.
I forget, Jim. Tell me again, where do you have some projects, some micro-housing projects being planned?
We have stuff on Capitol Hill. We finished one on First Hill. But we have stuff going on. We're just in the process of doing our early stuff in West Seattle. And we've got a project in Wallingford right this second. So,
and then you also said you've gone out of the state to other towns.
We're actually in Portland and in the Bay Area.
And how are those?
Going back to the East Coast to Jersey City, which is across from New York, to work on a project here middle of next month. So this is happening. This is a phenomenon that's happening across the country, and I actually believe across the world.
How are they being received in Portland, in Oakland? We're hearing these complaints from some in Seattle. How are they being received in these other municipalities?
Well, I think everywhere people are concerned. I don't think it's a Seattle-only phenomenon. I think people have legitimate questions and issues, and it's not like this product just sprung on them overnight. But people worry about who's going to live there and how are they going to affect my parking situation. Those are the two big issues. And I think they're legitimate issues whether you're in Portland or whether you're in Oakland or whether you're in New York City or wherever you are.
Yeah, but the who's going to live there, the implication of that is what? Is this a class issue? Is that a NIMBY issue? I understand the parking issue. What's the who's going to live there issue for the rest of the neighborhood?
It's who are these people? And there have been lots of suggestions of who they might be, and there's a lot of in communities in Seattle, there are people claiming that they're going to be people that are not like they are. And so I don't want to go into whether it's a Is that a class issue? I don't know. It's an issue of worrying about who's in their community.
How do you respond to those folks when they come to complain?
I say that we're long-term owners and managers of these properties, and we're going to make sure that they're good people.
How big are the
background checks on all our customers coming into our building? So we don't have problems with people.
How big are how big's the one in Wallingford? How many units will that one have?
It'll have about 60 rooms.
And how about the one on First Hill?
It's 40 rooms.
Just getting a sense of which one, how big they are overall. Where do you like to send people when you say, hey, go look at one? Where do you like to send them for Cowrie? Where do you like to tell people to go?
We're in the early stages. We have one finished on First Hill, and it's fully occupied. And frankly, that's something you need to know, that there's a big demand for this product out there, and we don't have any problem filling up our product.
Does the city council know that? I'm sure you've talked to some of them.
Yes, I've talked to all the city council people.
Do you feel that they are favorable to these in the long run? Do you think there's going to be a moratorium proposed?
Well, I heard your interview with Tom. He's not even suggesting a moratorium. He's saying that's one of the possibilities.
Yeah, I know he's talking about a brown bag lunch. Get everybody together.
I go and talk to folks all the time. I'm involved relating to talk to folks about this product and other product. I've been doing this smaller units for years. Not this small. They're gradually getting smaller as the costs have gone up.
Yeah, smaller houses, smaller units.
Very similar. It's an alternative. It's one of those things that some people would need to look at as part of their life cycle. Again, maybe they're young, just starting out. Maybe they have their family stored somewhere else, out on the perimeter somewhere, and they come into Seattle. We have customers that come and work 3 and 4 day weeks, and they need a place to stay while they're in. Maybe they're fishermen. I mean, we could go through a long list of. I could give you profiles of our customers, and you'll see who they are, the residents. But there are people from all over who just come to town and want to understand what Seattle's about and want a place to start out in.
Yep, they're the new they're us. All right, Jim.
They really are us. That's really my point.
Yeah, Jim Potter,
really
chairman of.
Different than you and I.
Just going to live in a smaller place.
Yep.
Jim Potter is chairman of Cowrie Investments. I appreciate you taking the time, Jim.
You're welcome, Steve.
Cowrie Investments, Eagle Rock Ventures, they're the folks that were on Capitol Hill that I was mentioning there, and also Calhoun. They're the developers of the apartments that Amina and Jeannie Yandel toured. We'll continue that conversation in a moment. This is Weekday.
Hi, this is Patricia Murphy. KUOW's spring membership drive starts April 1st. And you know what gets the momentum going? You. With your pledge of $1,000 or more, you can inspire listeners to call and have their donations matched by your challenge. For details, email majorgifts@kuow.org or call 206-221-2732. Thanks.
Probing the secrets of where we might have come from.
You know, Mars was warm and wet before Earth. Meteorites blasted from the surface of Mars. They may very well have delivered deep microbes, and therefore we're all Martians.
And the proof may lie deep under the Earth. I'm Steve Curwood. Join me for that next time on Living on Earth from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Bed Company. For more than 30 years, offering a selection of handcrafted organic mattresses, bed toppers, and pillows. More information and sleep resources are available by visiting their Fremont workshop or online at SoaringHeart.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:43. Former Secretary of State Clinton has announced her support for same-sex marriage, both personally and as a matter of policy and law. That's in our top-of-the-hour newscast, which is just about 15 minutes away.
Now, into the Stomptish, the water cooler, the chat room. We'll stick with Stomptish. Bernard likes that. Let's continue that conversation about microhousing and apartments. Leah Baltus is editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. Good to see you again, madam.
Good morning, sir.
Carl Spence, the artistic director of SIFT. It's good to see you in another capacity.
It's good to be here.
Though, you know, we'll talk film, too. It's good to see you. And Greg Garcia is executive director of WAPI, a nonprofit agency that serves youth of color, Washington Asian Pacific Islanders, in the greater Seattle area. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in here. All right, let me follow up on that micro house, that apartment issue. I'm going to start with you because city arts means that you live in the city and you care about a culture.
It's true. I live in 666 square feet.
Whoa, you're almost there.
Yeah, one husband, one cat, and one dog. I have in the past lived in 390 square feet, which was pretty freaking small.
Where was that?
In Fremont, and I'm not entirely sure it was legal.
Was it an older building?
It was a building that seemed to have been chopped up in a way that was not actually vetted by the city.
See, that's what I think is interesting. It's not like this is new. Go to any of the houses that have been chopped up around the U District, and there's a lot of people living in tiny places that probably haven't been vetted by the city. What do you think of the trend? Good thing for the city?
I mean, I think it's fine. It's another option for people, and if there's some reason, either for work or for school or for whatever, that somebody wants to choose to live in a space that small and they can't afford to live in a bigger space or they don't want to prioritize living in a bigger space, then they ought to be able to.
Now I was thinking, if you're serving young people, That's who this is for, people who could afford to stay in the city rather than having to leave.
Yeah, I mean, I seen one driving in right on 45th.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and there used to be houses there, but, you know. I guess from my angle, I don't have any problem with it either. In other countries, they have, you know, pods like this. In Japan, I know for sure, has that. And, you know, it's just a matter of... I guess, taste, like how much space does somebody really need to live in?
I'm the antagonist, I think, because I like the idea of it, but I think people want to know, and I'd want to know where they're going to be. And if you're moving into a nice residential neighborhood, not nice, but just a place with houses, do you want that just to be able to just change overnight where someone puts up, you know, a pod of 20 units right next door? So
yeah, that's sort of a different issue.
But I think so the idea of it, I think, is great. And I lived in Japan for a year in high school, and then I worked there for a bit. And I stayed in this, you know, something that would be like a pod. They even had pods you could stay in during, you know, your break at the airport, but which are even maybe like, you know, 50 square feet.
Yeah, those are even smaller. But there's two things that issues raised, and I want to quickly go over both of them. One is the parking issue. Is that legitimate? Should every apartment in this city be providing a parking space for their car?
Well, if the city made it free to park everywhere, it'd be perfect.
You'd have cars stacked on top of cars.
That was a joke.
I don't even have a parking space, and I own downtown. I mean...
Do you have a car?
Yeah.
So you have to park it somewhere?
I have to pay to park at the convention center, which has a parking garage next to my house, which is an expensive premium that I pay for not taking the bus to Greenwood every day.
That is.
Yeah.
Do you have a car?
Yeah, I have a car. I live in the suburbs now. But when I did, I used to live here in the U District, you know, parking was pretty crazy. And I can understand, like, if I'm living somewhere and all of a sudden this big, gigantic pod community comes in and, you know, everybody has cars, that's going to be nuts. It's already bad enough as it is out here, you know, in parking. But
difficult to regulate it, though, unless you force the developer to include a parking space, in which case your rent just went up and you're not building a small, cheap apartment.
But we're not requiring one-to-one parking spaces for other kinds of apartments at this point anyway. So, I mean, that's a ship that seems to have sailed.
You said a big pod of people. There's the other sort of rap that's coming on these. It's cheap. So some neighbors, and I don't think it's really that widespread, but some neighbors saying, well, who are these people that are going to move in there? As if they're not the same as the people living there now. Since you were antagonistic, I'll let you go, Carl. I mean, is that bigotry? Is that or not? And I don't mean like racial or ethnic. It's more like class bigotry or something.
Well, I think it's more what your expectations are for what you want your living environment to be. And just maybe it's more about control. Maybe I'm like to be controlling. But you know, it also can be really exciting. I mean, I was just in Austin, Texas, and you know, the vitality of having so many younger people around was really inspiring and really was enjoyable. I still go back to my hotel and get off the street and not be around a lot of drunk people late at night, but it was, so I guess it just depends on what your expectations are, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it actually could add to the vitality of the neighborhood. I mean, for many years, our offices were in South Lake Union and it was a dead zone. And now there's, you know, thousands of people there during the day and even in the evening. And it's a completely changed neighborhood for the better. So it brings life. More people does bring life. It's just the context And I think it's, I guess the issue people have right now is it seems like it's, there's a loophole that, you know, someone can come, just come in and make these without much planning. So it's, you could,
well, without design.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they do, they still have to go through the planning.
They still have to get a permit.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it would make more towards the trend of a 24-hour city, right? Because if everybody's living in these small apartments, as we hear, you're supposed to be making the rest of the city your living room and your dining room.
Right. Like, yeah, and then they could even push for more public transit, too.
No, that's crazy talk. More public transit.
One step at a time. Yeah.
What else did you find in Austin besides people, drunk people wandering the street?
I was there. It's sort of in the during the film festival portion, and also which crossed over with the interactive section before the music craziness happened. But it's pretty. I mean, it's just a lot of energy. It's pretty crazy how Austin has that perfect location in that downtown area where they can close off Sixth Avenue or Sixth Street, or some people call it Bourbon Street, where it's just a row of clubs and bars, and it's and it just goes on for blocks. On the film side, it's pretty interesting because they're really timed perfectly to capture and get many of those films that didn't get into Sundance. They have a strong emphasis on American films. I saw, for example, Joss Whedon's new film, Much Ado About Nothing, which had its U.S. premiere. It was in Toronto, but it's he made a film set at his house, around Shakespeare, the week after he came off doing The Avengers. It's sort of a therapeutic movie-making low budget for him. And it just invited, and just, you know, casts all of his favorite people he's worked with over the years from all of his shows and films and series. And I know it's a really great festival to discover new filmmakers. There's a lot of filmmakers that were, there's over 30 films that were crowdfunded there, which was interesting. I had a really good time. There's some good food. You know, I went out to have some good barbecue, and
you bought yourself some boots.
I didn't do any shopping. I was actually very good.
I want to come back to the crowdfunding, but I have a question for both of you. So Carl Spence is artistic director of SIFF. Leah Baltus is editor-in-chief of City Arts Magazine. And Greg Garcia is executive director of WAPI, a nonprofit agency that serves youth of color in the greater Seattle area. South by Southwest gets a lot of coverage in this area. It's important. KEXP is down there or tries to be, paying a lot of attention to it. Seattle Times has a blog. People go down there. Does it have any impact on the young people that you talk to, the artists that you might be working with, the young people that come?
Depending on which young people we're talking to, we serve youth from all over the city. And I think the youth that are not from the South End, like the North End and the CD, they might know a little bit more about it. But a lot of the youth from the South End have no idea what South by Southwest is. So I don't know if it has an effect. But once they do find out about it, though, you know, those are things like, oh, wow, I'm going to – they have some new goals, and they understand that, like, the music business is changing and, you know, there's more ways to get your music out there now.
How about the tech aspect of it? I mean, South by Southwest is also all about tech. And whenever we talk about tech, we talk about whether there's a growing divide. So does South by does them getting to know about it have any impact on their
tech?
Yeah, or they're thinking about tech or jumping into apps and the like.
You know, it's interesting because I don't know. I never really knew about the South by Southwest tech aspect. I just knew more of it from the music. I honestly haven't ever been to it myself. But you know, to answer your question, I think just by getting into music, they're involved in tech because we use computers for all the recording at WAPI when we do our stuff. So it's like a totally different process than, you know, years ago when it was reel-to-reel tapes and what have you, and reel splicing and editing, you know what I mean? So the tech is there, but I mean, maybe with the social media aspect, perhaps.
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
You know, and you have people coming into WAPI, right? Blue Scholars, others, people come in that work with those youth, and they are involved in the industry in pretty profound way.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of, you know, what we do, bringing local artists into WAPI. And then, because a lot of the youth, sometimes they don't know about it, because what they do know is, you know, youth from the artists from the radio. And to hear local artists talking about things that, you know, affect them more, you know, I think that's one of the great things, you know.
How important is South by Southwest up here in terms of culture, I mean, it does cover a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people cover it. A lot of people pay attention to it.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about music and film and interactive, those are three industries that Seattle cares a lot about. And in some ways, I don't know, South By to me is like a giant promotional effort. I mean, not that the people who go to it don't have a great time. But as far as I know, many, if not all of the bands that go down, make it down there on their own somehow so that they can be seen and there's an opportunity for that kind of industry moment. So in the sense that Seattle participates so heavily in those industries, I think South By has an impact on us.
It's also very interesting. The question is, why isn't something of that here? Because we actually have a much stronger music scene and business in terms of here in Seattle. We have the basis of the tech here, and we have we actually have the largest film festival in the country in terms of audience here. So it's like, why? But it is actually South by Southwest. It is actually a for-profit institution. It was founded by the guys who have the Chronicle, the newspaper there. And so it's, you do have to pay your way to get there. But what is the incubator that has created this sort of phenomenon of everyone cramming themselves into this smaller place to create something that's really cool and fun, wherein here in Seattle, we have all the elements here. Why?
I think part of it is that we have a kind of fuller festival landscape in general. So even before, at least for example, I'm a little biased coming from the City Arts perspective since we have a festival, but I think that, Bumbershoot's been around for a really long time. Block Party has been thriving for a really long time. Sasquatch now has been thriving for a really long time. And so when you have those three already in place and they have a whole different mechanism for functioning that doesn't rely on the same kind of dynamic financially, and even geographically, we're more the like put them all in a big fence kind of style most of the time, then it doesn't necessarily leave as much room maybe to figure something like that out.
Well, so here's my question that to wrap this. So how connected do the three of you feel to whatever South by Southwest can be labeled part of the Austin scene? Like how connected do you feel at WAPI to what happens at SIFF? Or the City Arts Festival, or the City Arts work, or more generally connected to the culture of the city, the region.
I feel more connected to all the SIFF and everything up here because just Seattle really cares about art and music, and that was something when I moved up here from California was really evident.
That's what you guys are trying to do at WAPI,
yeah,
right?
Is right.
Bring artists in and get those artists, the young people, producing art for the region.
Right, and just getting that whole next generation of that community, that artist community, especially in hip-hop, Because it's our art form has been tainted by the industry, so having the true hip-hop arts, I mean, that's what I think the festivals up here, they appreciate that.
I mean, and you guys have embraced local filmmaking, yes, at SIFF? I mean, in a way that it wasn't as prevalent or as powerful 20 years ago.
Yeah, we've always liked to highlight what's happened here, but there's been a burgeoning filmmaking scene that's really gone unnoticed, and it's come to light nationally more so in the last decade and in the last few years, even with the rise of the powerful women filmmakers that are really making it happen, with Megan Griffiths, who just finished shooting a film, whose film Eden is opening nationwide this next month. We're also opening it at the Uptown. Lynn Shelton, who has really been extraordinary in terms of giving back from what she's received in terms of her success. And so there's a lot to highlight and to celebrate here. I just wonder sometimes I feel like maybe we get too siloed. And it's true, there's all these really wonderful, vibrant things that are all separate entities. And is there a way that we could maybe work more closely together to create something that would be interesting? Because Seattle always seems, we always forget to sell. I don't think we sell ourselves as well as we could in Seattle. We always want, it's like, we're always undervaluing what we have here and looking at what's elsewhere in terms of our events. Because it's amazing. Seattle's an amazing place to live because of the cultural diversity and the arts and what we have to offer. Sometimes we forget that.
All right, so that's the big deal that you have to do with your City Arts Festival. All right, I've left you enough time to say what's something big coming up in arts that you want people to to know about to highlight, oh given goodness. What we just described?
Well, there's a ton. I mean, it's hard to even imagine.
Name one. You can only name one within the next 2 weeks.
I go to press in 2 days, Steve. my brain is not tracking things in that way.
All right,
we're certainly looking up to. We're looking forward to SIF, and we're working on a lot of stuff right now that kind of relates exactly to what Carl was just talking about, because there is a lot of local filmmaking going on right now, and some of that even ties to the stuff that was showing down at South By. So there's a link. Dana Hansen's Improvement Club that just had its premiere.
You didn't believe me when I said you just had one. Right. And you have films coming up, and you have CDs coming out. Yeah. And now I'm out of time. I apologize. Carl Spence is Artistic Director at SIF. Name one film that you got coming up soon.
I'll name one right now. War Witch is playing right now. It was an Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Language Film. It's an amazing film. You should see it.
All right. And Greg Garcia is Executive Director of WAPI, the nonprofit agency serving youth of color around the region, around Seattle, putting out art and music and training them. And Leah Baltus, Editor-in-Chief of City Arts. Thank you.
It's 11 a.m. Later today, during the noon hour, we're going to talk about the sharing economy. What is it? Well, it's a personal exchange of goods and services. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.